Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. This is the Live Event. In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone, and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KV at MTOR, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of the Night Zone. As we prepare for the fall season, make sure you stay tuned for some very exciting changes. In order for these changes to be market effective, we need your help. After listening to the Night Zone, either live or in archive, please take time to rate the show or mark as many of the shows as you wish as a favorite. Even in the cyber world of radio, ratings count. Tonight's guest is Bonnie Jones Reynolds, author of the book The Magdalene. Bonnie grew up in Clinton, New York on a family farm, which has been in the family since the mid-1800s. Now an animal sanctuary headquarters for Spring Farm Cares Animal Sanctuary. Bonnie Jones Reynolds has had a colorful journey, hobnobbing with kings and queens, movie royalty, and movers and shakers of the TV and radio world. Writing a number of best-selling books, The Truth About Unicorns, The Confetti Man, and now The Magdalene. We are very pleased to have Bonnie with us tonight, and we'll be talking to Bonnie when we return.
Bring you this story, we interrupt our program. Take you to Washington.
I have just returned from the White House, where the United States...
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you...
There's not much question at all what there's like throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. Your host, Colin Knight.
And indeed, is there anybody out there? Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Night Zone. It is Tuesday, August the 10th, 2010. I'm absolutely amazed we are here live on air. Technical glitches continue to plague Blog Talk Radio, but we will fight our way through it as we always do. Now, I know you hear me say this often, but tonight is an exceptional night. With us tonight, Bonnie Jones Reynolds, actress, model, author, and a practitioner of interspecies, or animal communication practitioner. So, Bonnie Reynolds, good evening, and welcome to the Night Zone.
Welcome to you. Welcome to my office. This is very nice to have you join me.
Well, it's great for you to be here. Bonnie, before we get started, let me throw out a special thanks to Stacy at Smith's Publicity for making this interview happen tonight. Without those people, I tell you, I don't know where our shows would be. They bring the information to us, and look, I have you here. It's got to be a good thing.
I will pass on to her your kind comments. It'll mean a lot to her.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So Bonnie, as a child, according to the beginning there, as a child in Clinton, New York, you wanted to be a nun and a ballerina, but ended up becoming a successful model. That's a huge professional switch. How did you get there?
Well, you know, it's amazing, Colin, how people can hold in their mind mutually exclusive ideas. I literally was planning to become a nun at the same time that I was planning to become a ballerina. And at some point, I think it's when I became interested in boys, is when I decided to go for the ballerina rather than the nun. But when I got down to New York City, I went to the School of American Ballet, Balanchine School, and I was terrible. I mean, I had been taught all wrong. The darling teacher in our hometown had meant well, but I had not learned even the basics correctly, so there was no way that I was going to be the world's greatest prima ballerina. At the same time, my very first day in New York City, I accompanied another girl who was going to make the rounds of the model agencies, and lo and behold, I got not only picked but signed to an exclusive contract at one of the model agencies. And at that point, you know, the corps de ballet of the New York City Ballet Company was making $60 a week for straining their guts out 12 hours a day at the bar. That's the bar, a ballet bar, not the regular bar. And, at my very first time out, I posed with a bowling ball, and they gave me $60 for the hour, and they even gave me the bowling ball and the shoes. So I decided, I think I'm going to be a model and not a ballerina.
Well, you're going to need to start. You needed to start modeling against cars, so they would give you a car. That's the way to work it. You see, $60 a day, $60 an appearance.
An hour,
wasn't bad.
Yeah.
Wasn't bad at all, was it?
Back in 1955, that was pretty good.
That was pretty darn decent. Now your mom was a devout Methodist.
Yes.
And your dad was an atheist, but a very learned man, I understand.
That is correct. That is definitely correct. As a matter of fact, my father does have a published book of his own. It was published in England called The Forest Man. He was very proud of that.
Interesting. Did he come from England originally?
No, but he did that novel when I was just 2 years old, and he had broken his leg. And he was bedridden for about 6 months, waiting for the leg to heal. And he put a typewriter on his stomach and started writing. But then he threw the novel that he finished into a chest. And in the 1970s, I took it out of the chest and read it and said, hey, this is pretty good. So I gave it to my then agent, who got it published in England for him, and it was a great surprise for my father in his later life.
Oh, he must have been as proud as punch for that.
Yep, yep.
Wow, impressive. So you grew up, obviously, your mother was the religious influence in your life. Mm-hmm. And as you came through, you mentioned in your bio that your father was a historian, so to speak. He had this urge to understand Roman and I forget what Spanish history. I mean,
Roman and conquistadores. Yes.
Conquistador, that's right, yeah.
And
you went in another direction. You were looking for saints and you were looking for the path of religion.
I went for very much for Middle Eastern and biblical history and English history. Those were my forts. Oh. But both he and I, we just any history we gobbled up. We both had the same disease.
Yeah. Yeah, my father and I are exactly the same way, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was exactly the same thing. History, for some reason, it bit me at a very, very early age and continues to drive me absolutely crazy. I can't get enough of it. But, of course, the paranormal and all of that stuff has kind of taken the lead. And I have to say that when I read your information that Stacey sent me, Bonnie, I was enthralled. It just caught me as such a rounded individual that has done so much, meeting with you know, almost royalty around the world as one part of your life. That must have been fascinating.
I have lived a dozen lives in one, and
yeah.
I feel I'm only halfway there because I intend to live to be 150. So I have a lot more lives to live. I mean, to me, life is such a delicious, wonderful thing. You know, it just there is just so much to do and so little time, so much to learn and so little time. I'm a very greedy person that way, in that I gobble up experience, and somehow I attract it.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's I wish that everybody would feel the same way, Bonnie, to be honest with you. I think education and learning is the answer to the questions that we're looking for.
I can't understand people who, you know, our last president, Mr. Bush, when he said he was not a very curious person, I don't understand people who aren't curious, but, you know, that's
right.
Another whole story.
Yeah. Oh, boy, we could get into a great deal of information on that, I'll tell you. So anyway, as I was reading your bio, and we will get to your book, I promise, but there's just so much more. There's so much more I need to know about you, because your bio fascinated me. You've worked as a model on the Dave Garraway Today Show, The Big Payoff, The Price is Right, and you were a Glee girl. One of the June Taylor dancers on the Jackie Gleason show.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wasn't one of the dancers. What happened is that there were the dancers, and then there were the showgirls, the Glee girls, who worked with the dancers. I was one of the showgirls.
Okay. Did you ever get the chance to talk to Jackie Gleason about his UFO experience and beliefs?
No, I didn't know anything about that. You know, Jackie was a total gentleman. As far as all of us girls were concerned, he had his girlfriends, and he was very true to his girlfriends. And he didn't, you know, the only thing, every time that we would rehearse, and, you know, there was that walk down toward the camera at the beginning of the show. Each one of the showgirls would walk toward the camera. And as I walked down, he would say, "Here she comes, Miss Corn-Fed Smile."
Corn-fed smile. Well,
yeah.
That's something to live with, isn't it? Corn-fed smile. Wow. You have been in a number of well-known TV shows also. I was reading the list, and the list goes on and on. Naked City, The Doctors, Perry Mason, Living Doll, Man from U.N.C.L.E., one of my all-time favorite shows, I Wanted to Be Ilya Kuryakin. I wanted to be Ilya. I thought that he was just the meow of everything, you know.
Uh-huh.
What did you play on The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Oh my God, it's so long ago, you know, and I never even saw the show. It was I was someone in an office that they were dealing with, and I cannot truly remember even the script. You go and you do those things, and that would be what the work you did that day, and then you'd go on the next thing the next day.
Exactly. And my second all-time favorite show, of course, Hogan's Heroes, and you were on there too. Now, do you remember the character you played on there?
I worked with the Underground. helping them on one of their escapades. I was only on one show, and interestingly enough, in that show, Bill Christopher, who was later Father Mulcahy, played a Nazi officer in that show. But the
jocularity.
Hmm?
You see, you say on MASH, you used to say jocularity.
Right. My husband, who I later married, was the director on Hogan's Heroes, which is how I happened to know the whole bunch of guys there. And then, of course, moved on to MASH later on.
Yeah. Any stories out of Hogan's Heroes you can tell on the air in a G rating?
what can I tell you? They were a great bunch of guys. Bob, of course, was a very spicy character. The boys all used to love to tease my husband whenever I was around the set, and they would all be hugging me and kissing me and pulling me into corners, and my darling husband was so involved in his material that he never even noticed. So they finally gave up.
Uh, He noticed. He just wasn't going to give them the ability.
He wasn't going to fall for it.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, Bonnie, please don't take this as, you know, but you were clearly, if you were a model in New York City at a high level like that and on these shows, you obviously had the looks and the brains to pull it off. And he noticed. He noticed. I could tell you that. Now, you married Gene Reynolds, who mm-hmm. was the director, and that got you to Room 222 and MASH.
Mm-hmm.
Were you on MASH when Henry was the boss or Sherman Potter?
When Henry was on, yeah. Gene and I broke up during the fourth year of the show, so right. I was basically involved with the first 4 years of MASH.
Gotcha. And you were a nurse?
I was always a nurse, usually schmoozing with Hawkeye or with Trapper, one or the other.
Yeah, one of the, interchangeable with those guys for sure. I'm gonna have to go back on my MASH episodes now because I'm going to go looking for you. Do you know that, Bonnie? I'm going to go find you on an episode. So was there anything memorable about the MASH episodes that you remember?
Well, I think maybe the most memorable thing that I remember about MASH is being on the set whenever McLean Stevenson was on the set. This man was
right.
probably the funniest person who ever lived on the face of the earth. I mean, he couldn't
really?
Move without, you know, being funny. And it was very hard to get through a day. When McLean was there, he would have everybody. I mean, he would be, you know, going off and doing shticks all over the place.
Yeah.
And he would have everybody on the floor laughing. So that,
yeah.
you know, as I say, it was very difficult to do a scene when McLean was involved. I think that probably is the thing I remember the most about being
yeah.
on the set. There was one.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to tell
go
you
ahead.
there was one funny story about what which is a little bit different. But we were invited one night. At that time, Liza Minnelli was married to the son of Jack Haley, or the mm-hmm. one who was in Wizard of Oz with her mother Judy. And we were invited, the whole MASH cast was invited to their home one night. And Liza told a funny story, and this might get us into our animal business, but it seemed that she had lost her little poodle. And she had been hysterical about losing the poodle, and she said, you know, I hate to do this, but she said, I called every radio show in town and said, I hate to pull rank, but I'm Liza Minnelli, and I've lost my dog. And she had the entire, every radio show in the Los Angeles area advertising for her dog, and she did get it back. So,
well, for goodness sake.
That's
for
one memory.
No doubt. During this time, you wrote two novels, The Truth About Unicorns and The Confetti Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, that must have been quite the episode.
Well, it was very interesting because... you know, I was. It was the joke among all of Gene's friends, the writers and everything. These high-powered writers who were doing
right.
all of these shows, and they would kind of giggle and smile and say, "Gene's cute little wife is in the corner. She's writing a novel. Isn't that cute?" And some of them never forgave me when I got it published. Literally. Larry Marks, he was called Fat Larry because there were two Larry Markses, so I'm not being nasty by saying this, but it was Fat Larry Marks, who was absolutely furious with me for writing that novel. It was quite interesting. You know, those were still the days when we women would call a restaurant if we were going out that night, and we would ask if it was permissible to wear a pantsuit. So,
wow.
you know, that was back in the days before women's lib really got rolling.
Yeah,
it's amazing
So it was almost impossible to believe that a woman was capable of writing a novel.
Yes, especially, you know, this pretty little trick that was married to Jean. You know, she is trying to be serious about this whole thing. So.
Yeah, I could see the male misogynist during those times. Yeah, I could see that quite easily. Now, in January, after your divorce with Jean and you moved to Australia, you wrote a yoga class beginner's book for Burkham Chowdhury, which I've actually read. I was shocked when I came across the name. I've actually read that book. And it's like, oh, my goodness. But in January the 20th, 1980, you had an enlightenment when you read Seth Speaks by the late Jean Roberts.
Yeah.
That was a life-changing time for you.
It was, and that's why I remember that day. As a matter of fact, I have a photograph that was taken of me sitting on the balcony reading that book that day here on my desk, because it was really a day of rebirth for me. You know, we talked about my mother being the Methodist, my father being the atheist, and me being... I was really ridiculously religious as a kid. You know, for Lent, I would give up my bed and sleep on the floor, that kind of thing. And when I got to New York City, I began, hobnobbing with people who were atheists and who were very educated and were privy to much of the research that had been done as far as biblical studies were concerned. And they, they began to make fun of me. And in order to combat them, I began to study like crazy. And I found out, oh, my God, they're right. They're right. Everything that I've been taught is just, it's a sham. It's all a lie. It's all a fabrication. And so I became an atheist myself. But something deep within me said, no, that's not right. So then I went to becoming an agnostic. And I launched onto a full-time career of studying the supernatural, the things that go bump in the night, religions. I studied comparative religions. In my second marriage, by the way, I did convert to Judaism, which was a very foolish thing for me to do, but it seemed like a good thing at the time. But what that did was give me even more of an opportunity to study the Jewish religion and the history even more deeply. So by the time that of January 20th, 1980, when I picked up the Seth book, I was ready because I had so many questions. Nothing had made sense to me ever. I would get one thing and then another thing, and I was very, very confused, as most people really are when they're looking and searching. And I started reading that book, and all the pieces fell into place. It was like I flew to the stars. Suddenly, everything was answered. Suddenly, everything made sense. And basically, since that time, I have governed my life according to the teachings of Seth in that book, which are very Christ-like, and it's not Christ 101; it's very advanced Christ that one gets in the books of Jane Roberts.
Right. Now, Jane Roberts channeled Seth, and there's a number of issues that our listeners might be interested in. Seth was born after the slaying of Abel and Cain, and Eve believed God had appointed him to replace Abel, whom Cain had killed. And according to Genesis, Seth was born when Adam was 130 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That fascinates me, that the age of people was such a level that we can't even get to 130 years today.
Yeah, I was just reading something today, as a matter of fact, in the paper, and they're talking about the aging process being involved with the pituitary, and that at a certain point, it's not that the pituitary, I think it's the pituitary, does not produce enough of the growth hormone that we need, but that it stops releasing it. And at that moment, as I read that, I said, ah, that's the key, because back then, when they lived so much longer, somehow that pituitary kept releasing that hormone that was needed to stop the aging process.
Yeah. I wonder if we are capable of releasing that chemically in today's society, because, you know, we're good at what we do nowadays. I mean, as far as the advancement of the genetic code and everything.
Well, I told you I'm planning to go to 150, so I'm working on it, definitely.
I'm with you all the way, girl, I tell you. You know, I figure they say only the good die young, so I've got a very, very long life. There we go.
Well, that lets me out. But I don't qualify for that at all.
Yeah. Well, according to my two exes, I'm going to live very, very long life. I was quick.
According to my exes also.
So in 82, you returned to help on the farm when your dad got ill and couldn't work anymore. And this is where you started writing The Magdalene.
Yes.
Coming home must have been one heck of a grounding experience.
It was, and you can come home again. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
They're very wrong that you can't come home again. It was the best thing I ever did. Interestingly enough, you know, as throughout my career, at one point I loved my mother and hated my father, and then I began to understand his problems, so then I hated my mother and loved my father. And when I came home again, I had the privilege of getting to really know them and appreciate them as human beings and as friends. And we just had wonderful years together when I came home, and it's that's when the Magdalene blossomed. It just came bubbling out of me. It had to be written.
Right. Now, so in a nutshell, we'll get to the Magdalene. We'll do a quick break at the bottom of the hour here, and then we'll get to the Magdalene, because I do want to hear about the story because it's fascinating. But I just want to sidestep just a little bit here. When you went home, obviously this farm has been around since the 1800s. This has been in your family for a long, long time. Did you find it difficult adapting back to that world from the world that you came from?
No, not at all. I'm a very adaptable person. People would ask me if I didn't miss Hollywood. I missed being near the ocean. I missed the sun. Having so many days of devoid of sunlight here in upstate New York can be pretty depressing. Mm-hmm. I missed some of my friends. Other than that, no, I was very happy because I was very involved, first with getting the Magdalene written, and second of all, I became very, very involved with the animal sanctuary. And so I didn't really have time to worry about anything except, you know, the next adventure that I was embarked upon.
Gotcha. Yeah, I often wonder about that because I traveled the world for quite some time. Then I went home, and I saw my parents totally different than when I left. When I left, I was very much like you. I loved my mother, hated my father, and the older I grew, the more intelligent these people became. I thought they were the most stupidest people on the planet. And then, you know, and as I go back, I realized how intelligent they were with some of the advice they had given me over the years. And by the time both my parents had died, they were geniuses. They were absolute geniuses. It's amazing how that works.
Yes, I understand totally.
Yeah. I tell you what, we're going to take a quick break, bottom of the hour. We'll be back in about a minute 30, and we'll get to the Magdalene. How's that sound?
Okay.
All righty. We'll be right back, people. Don't you dare go away, because we got lots more on deck here.
We'll be right back with Bonnie Jones Reynolds and her book, The Magdalene, right after this pause for the cause. You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
And if you believe, in very simple terms, that people mean you well, and will treat you kindly, they will. And if you believe that the world is against you, then so it will be in your experience.
The words of Seth channeled to Jane Robinson.
Your beliefs meet you in the face when you look in the mirror. They form your image. You cannot escape your beliefs. They are, however, the method by which you create your being.
The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KVM Tour.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
Your host, Colin Knight.
And we are live with Bonnie Jones Reynolds, person extraordinaire. I have to say that Bonnie has quite a colorful past, absolutely impressive on her resume and her bio. And there's a number of books out there written by Bonnie that definitely deserve you to look at. If you go to the Night Zone website, you will see her books up there, and we do invite you to have a perusal of them, pick them up, read them. There's some good information up there. And I'm watching Blog Talk right now, waiting for them to kick me free so I can open up the phone line back to Bonnie. But, of course, they like to be difficult every so often, and they don't like me to open up phone lines every so often. So we'll just wait for the reload on the Blog Talk. In 1991, Bonnie incorporated Spring Farm Cares and became a practitioner of interspecies or animal communication. And we will, if we have time, we will most certainly get to the Spring Farm Cares program and process. Until then, we talk. Pick him up.
Hello?
There you
Hello?
Are.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there. Good. I can hear you loud and proud there, Bonnie.
Okay.
So, in a nutshell, what is the Magdalene all about?
Well, should I read the little blurb from the back of the cover?
You can do whatever your little heart desires,
okay.
Bonnie.
Well, this is going to give people an idea. For close to 2,000 years, humanity has been misled and lied to by a cherry-picked New Testament, a hodgepodge of rehashed myth and legend, garbled history, misinformation and misunderstanding, outright fabrication and crushing male bias, all patched together by the victors in the struggle to control the sheep of the kingdom. For millennia, this fabrication has been called reality by apostles, priests, rulers, and governments corrupted and consumed by arrogance and by the lust for power, riches, and control. For too long, Christians have drunk the blood, eaten the flesh, and gazed with perverted pleasure upon a gory death that supposedly relieved them of any need to accept responsibility for their own deeds. The Magdalene is a story whose time has come. Truth time has come. Meet your friend Jesus, who you can truly love, even adore for the first time in your life. Laugh with him, love with him, dance with him. Sit beside him and learn of the true God, all that is. Then witness the confusion that gave rise to the 2,000-year debacle that we call Christianity. Understand that the message was supposed to be joy and allow Jesus to come down off of that cross.
Wow.
That gives you an
wow.
idea of what the book is about.
Absolutely. Now you wrote this after you'd gone back home to the family farm,
mm-hmm.
and while you were caring for your infirm father.
Mm-hmm.
Was your mom still around at that time?
Oh yes. I but she needed help, and so that's why I went back to help her.
Right.
But
did she influence you as you were writing?
As she would read it, she'd say, "Oh, Bonnie, what is my Bible class going to say?"
So she was, you were driving her nuts even then.
All right.
That's good. That's good. That's excellent. That's absolutely excellent. And so how long did it take you to write the Magdalene?
I worked on it for close to 3 years because the Magdalene, it's over 700 pages. It weighs 2 pounds, 7 ounces. I mean, it's what one might call a heavy read. It's a big book, and being the historian that I am, I spent a great deal of time. I mean, this thing is so full of very, very careful scholarship as far as the history, the social, the political history is concerned, and also the biblical history. The thing is that I remember doing all of that research, and I remember writing certain parts of the book. But when it came to what Josh, I call Jesus in my book is Josh, because that's what Mary, who is the Magdalene, Mary Magdalene, called him. Whenever he would start to speak or whenever Mary would start to speak, I don't remember writing it. The words were just there. I didn't have to think anything out. The words just flowed into my mind. And I truly believe that I'm a foot soldier and that I was given my marching orders 2,000 years ago. And
I think we're all foot soldiers.
Yes. Those like you, Colin, and like myself, there are so many of us out there, and people don't even realize that they're foot soldiers. They don't realize that they are here and born again into this time and place to help humanity go forward into a brand new conscious evolution. We're going into a new 6,000-year experiment in consciousness. And we are here to help the species make that transition. My whole life led up to the writing of the Magdalene. I was born to write the Magdalene. That's why I came here, and that's why I spent all the time I did searching and wandering the pathways of of psychology and sociology and religion and things that go bump in the night, trying to find my way and to finally remember what it was that I had come here to do.
And the interesting thing about it is the Magdalene ties back to your childhood when you would search for saints and and the religious way. Isn't that an interesting way that the seed was planted at a very, very early age, and it took until mid-80s or so for you to bring this out to fruition.
Yes, that's right. And I can promise people, by the way, that a lot of people might be frightened to read the Magdalene because they think that some of their cherished beliefs are going to be disturbed. I can promise people. The interesting thing is that the people that I'm getting the most wonderful response from are dyed-in-the-wool Catholics, people who up till now have been very, very steeped in the Catholic religion. They are loving this book because something magic happens when you start reading this, because the message being given is a message of truth. And as I told you, I cannot really take responsibility I cannot take credit for all that Josh and Mary say. That came, that flowed, that was given, and it's being given to you. And people are going to come out of the reading of this book with a more wonderful Jesus, a more wonderful faith than they ever were given by their religions before this. It's giving to people. It's not going to take anything away from anyone.
I'm with you on that. Well, our people in the Night Zone, our listeners, our loyal shadow listeners, I have to tell you, they're fearless. I have brought to them to the table things that would curl your toes, and they've handled them very, very well.
Well, during the break, I heard you mention the Anunnaki. And I even, and Josh even obliquely refers to the Anunnaki in the Magdalene.
Absolutely fabulous. Well, you I know I'm going to get a raft of mail, and believe me, I'll share them with you as long as they don't have any nasty words in them. But we will pass on any email that we do get through the Night Zone regarding the Magdalene. Now, this book, it took you, you say, a couple of years to write?
It took about 3 years to write, yes. But I wrote it 25 years ago.
Right. Right,
It's been in a trunk, and even the manuscript was even lost in the fire in the intervening years. But it managed to survive.
Amazing. And it survived for a reason, obviously.
Well, absolutely for a reason. The fact that it's taken me 25 years to get this thing, I knew that when the Magdalene's time had come, it would be published. When I first, after I finished it, I sent it to my then agents, and they were horrified. They were scandalized.
Right.
This was before any of the books that we know of, and certainly before things like the Da Vinci Code or anything like that.
Right.
My agent said, "You can't publish this. You've got to change that ending. You can't put this out there, And so I put it in the trunk and said, okay.
Right.
Everyone kept telling me, you've got to change it. I said, I'm not going to change it. It's not going to be changed. This is
it's
what is supposed to be given to the world, and this is what I'm going to give. And the Magdalene will decide when its time has come.
Yeah.
And it did.
And its time has come, 700 and some pages, and it's out there full and proud for people to pick up. I believe we have a picture link on our site, on the Night Zone Blog Talk Radio site, and people can click on that and have a look at the information and how to acquire it through the internet and everything. So they will, I'm quite sure we'll be seeing some of those in the next week, 2 weeks or so, and especially on the archive download when Europe gets a hold of this show, I'm sure we'll definitely get some movement on that. Now, in 91, you went through some pretty rough financial times, as everybody did in the 90s, and it was a rocky financial time for everybody, wasn't it?
I got caught in that housing the housing crash in Los Angeles in 86, and I just lost my shirt and because I had bought a house as an investment, and it was just a catastrophe. I just lost everything there, everything that I spent, everything that I got, was to take care of the animals that I was beginning to acquire. And so that finally in 1991, a friend of mine who was an accountant finally convinced me that the only way to survive was to become a not-for-profit organization. And that's when Spring Farm Cares was born.
Right. And you incorporated Spring Farm Cares in 91. Now, you're a practitioner of interspecies, animal communication.
Well, okay. I and my partner, my co-founder here at Spring Farm, my business partner, is a girl named Dawn Heyman. She is, I always tell people when you compare our talents, I'm like mom and pop cutting a mean rug on a Saturday night, and she is Fred Astaire. She is one of the world's leading animal communicators, and I happily shelter in her shadow. But Spring Farm Cares is the whole idea was, both of us are followers of Seth, or of what the teachings in the Seth books.
Right.
And when we incorporated Spring Farm Cares, we agreed that we were going to test out Seth's theories, that you create your own reality, which, as far as we've concerned, we are concerned, we definitely did. And it was very much based on the fact that all is one, that everything in the universe communicates, that telepathy is the universal language that communicates to each and every molecule and atom and bit of energy in this universe, and that everything is one and is in communication with itself at all times. And that you know, the fact that it's a fact that humans and animals communicate telepathically one to the other. People do it all the time and they don't realize it. Right. The animals have no problem understanding that they pick up on everything that we humans are doing, but we humans have convinced ourselves that we're the only ones who can communicate, and all those animals out there are dumb creatures. And so right. We don't even listen to the messages that we're getting all the time from them.
Yep, and I can relate to that because for many, many years I had a golden Labrador named Sam. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to talk to Sam anymore. I just had to look, and he knew, and he knew when I wasn't feeling good, when I was sad, when I was happy. He knew. It was just a knowledge that I couldn't explain at the time. But the more I understand, obviously, the clearer it becomes.
Yes, you know, people pick up differently. Some people pick up through feeling. Some people pick up through images. Some people, words come into their minds. Everybody picks up and sends differently. I personally get feelings and images, which I then translate into my language of English. There is no one way to communicate. There are many, many ways. Some people get their communications in colors. We've had quite a few people who have come to our workshops because we teach this skill, and it's a skill that we're all born with. We just have to be reminded of what we've forgotten. And we've had several people who basically get all of their communications with colors that appear in their mind.
Yeah, I could see how a number of different methods of getting that information was possible. I firmly believe that the more we have socialized as human beings, the more we have lost our capacities, such as telepathy. I believe we're capable of it. I think everybody's capable of it. We've just forgotten how to switch on that motor or open that door.
Mm-hmm. It's before this last 6,000-year experiment, humanity was very much in tune with the animals and with the earth. And then when the patriarchal societies took over, this was severely stomped upon. And we became very left-brain creatures instead of right-brain creatures. And what we need to do now is to find a balance between the right and the left brain, but we must bring back right brain thinking, we must do this in order to survive as a species and go forward into this marvelous conscious evolution that is waiting for us if only we will take it.
Right. Well, one of our guests that comes on periodically, John Hogue from HogueProphecy.com, he has a statement that I use quite regularly regarding the age that we are moving into. And he said, we've come to an age where we have been looking and searching. Now we are moving into an age of knowing.
Uh-huh.
We are going to know our capabilities.
You know, that's exactly what happened to me when I picked up the Seth book. And, you know, I had been in an age of looking and searching and suddenly when I picked up the Seth book, everything fell into place and I knew. It was a gnosis that I underwent when I started reading that book.
I must admit, the Seth teachings are absolutely fascinating. And they do change your take on life and even on your business practices. I think there's a lot to be learned in those ancient histories.
Absolutely. One of the things that you learn is that the motive power of the universe is love. People don't understand that love is a thing. Emotions are things. They are literally things. And emotions move mountains. And the emotion that can move the biggest and the highest mountain, the furthest, is love. And right. If only people would understand that and begin to use that instead of the hate and the fear and the greed that is gripping our species at the moment, they would see they would see such miracles begin to happen.
Well, I think the universal energy. I'm very much a metaphysicist, and the universal energy, I think, can be soured into a negative energy from all of these hate mongers around the world,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And the universal energy will pour that energy around the earth. So if you can turn that energy into a positive and, as you say, love, I firmly believe that we would find peace in our time.
You know, your listeners are probably all familiar with David Icke, and he feels that whether or not you agree with his theories about the reptilians, he feels that they feed on the negative energy, and that they create situations that will make this negative energy because it's their food, and the way to stop
right.
them is to love, is to stop hating, to stop putting out that negativity and love, and we would stop them dead in their tracks. Whether or not you believe that, it's a very interesting theory.
Well, I have a scientist friend actually lives in the New York area, and she tells me that the silliness of life that we have right now is that if you were an extraterrestrial and you were thinking of coming to Earth, the actual sounds that we emit. Via electronic
horrible.
Otherwise, it's horrible. It's screechy, scary, violent, and she said that alone is going to keep those thousand, 100,000, million year old species from coming to talk to us until we learn that we're of value to the universe as opposed to just Earth. And I thought about that for a while, and I wasn't quite sure what she meant, so I asked her, well, what do you mean about the screechy, scratchy noise? So she sent me a wave file of the noises that are heard electronically from outer space when focused on Earth, and it's disgusting. I mean, it would, if you listen to that noise for any length of time, you would go crazy.
Yes. There's a marvelous movie called Contact with Jodie Foster. I watched it many times, and in the very beginning of that, it starts out with these horrible Earth sounds being thrown out into space. No doubt about it. It's not terribly inviting to creatures of love and light, but I do believe that creatures of love and light would force their way through it. Because wanting to help us, wanting to give to us what they're able to impart to us.
Right. Do you think they are still influencing Earth, or do you think they're just sitting back and seeing what we do with the information we've been given?
By the way, I have had probably at least a dozen situations where I've either seen UFOs or been very much involved with sightings of various kinds.
Interesting.
I tend to believe that there is more than one group parked up there watching us, and that some of them are very much in our corner and helpful, and others may not be quite might be a little nastier. Tends to be my opinion of the matter, but of course I do not know any more than anybody else does.
Yeah, it's all speculation at this point in time, but I tend to agree with you. I think as there are ignorant and rude people on Earth. I'm sure there are out there in the cosmos somewhere that you know, they would follow the same vein. So, you mentioned earlier regarding every molecule is communicating and the likes. In the native tradition, they have what they call the Nanatu, or the spirit of everything that man is and everything that we are on Earth, and they arguably say that the Manitou is the one that sends the information, and yet we seem to be deaf to the information that they are providing to us. Do you think that the enlightenment, as you say, that is coming, do you think this could be tied in any strange way to 2012,
to
the prophecies of 12?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And of course, it's not going to be the end of the world. It's going to be the end of the world possibly as we know it. It's the time when we can, now of course, you have to take into consideration probabilities. There are all kinds of probabilities that are going to happen. If everybody wants to go into a good probability, stick with me because that's where I'm going. I'm going into a good probability. Yes, definitely. The Mayans, I think, were somehow along the way were given information from some of our watchers, some of our friends, and that's why they were able to chart things and know things as well as they did. And you know, we have another 2 years to get our act together, but I think maybe the critical mass will be reached. I'm sure you're familiar with the 100th monkey. That critical mass, I think, is being reached. People don't realize, but there are probably at this point over 30% of the people on the Earth are thinking as we think, Colin, but a lot of them are afraid to say that they're thinking as we think. Amazing. Sure. The critical mass, the tipping point, when suddenly an idea becomes the property of the entire species is really very small, and we are close to that now. We can do it.
Yeah.
We can do it.
Yeah, we. And, you know, speaking of we can do it, I can't believe we've blown through an hour already. how do people get a hold of you? Springfarmcares.org would be the best way to go. And, of course, the Magdalene, the book's available. Go to our website, your website, and be able to find a copy there.
Yeah. Right? My website is just plain BonnieJonesReynolds.com.
BonnieJonesReynolds.com,
yeah.
Fabulous. Bonnie, it's been an absolute pleasure, my dear.
It has. Thank you so much, Colin. I really had fun.
And I look forward to you coming back at another time.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night. Ladies and gentlemen, Bonnie Jones Reynolds and the book The Magdalene. And pick it up and have a look at it. Read it out because it is an absolutely fabulous read. I read the cliff copies, and I'm getting ready to pick up the full copy. But, you know, like Bonnie said, it's a heavy read, 700 and some pages, but it's worth it because it has information in there that I think that everybody will enjoy. And I think the abilities of people are going to get bigger and better, and I think we're catching on to this. You know, we're going to get this organized in time. For that magic time of 2012. But it's going to take everybody out there to believe in it. And, you know, once you buy into it, it's pretty easy. We got to go. So we hope you people will take care of yourselves. And you remember always, as we say, you know, help somebody out there. There's people out there that need help.
Hey, Night Zone, you've got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.